The Bookshelf, what you should be reading.
I think you've got the idea there. We are talking about James Bond on the show today because on the bookshelf we have Forever and a Day by Anthony Horowitz. It was published on the 31st of May, just a couple of days ago, and it is the prequel to Casino Royale. It's the story of how James Bond becomes 007. It's set in the brutal underworld of the French Riviera. And we have Charlie Scott, books publisher at Motivate Publishing, with us on the show today. Hello, Charlie.
Hi there. Great to be here.
I think it's quite fitting that you're here to talk about this, because the last time you were on the show, you were telling us a rather horrific story about... Well, you were telling us about Casino Royale being one of your favourite books, first of all.
Yes, absolutely. The beginnings of Bond was Casino Royale, and was a really formative book for many of us, as the idea of this an iconic character such as Bond, when they first arrive on the page, I think is one of the most exciting things in anything. And Casino Royale is a lovely book because of that. And yes, I had a quite personal connection to it because somewhere out there is a first edition signed Casino Royale, but it's not in my possession. It's gone to a jumble sale thanks to my dear darling mother, and we are searching the back lanes of England still trying to track it down. So
every time I hear the story, I think I've heard it quite a few times now, I'm genuinely actually crying a little bit because it is very sad. So this one, Forever and a Day, what did you think?
I thought it was wonderful. I think with an established character like Bond, there's always the bit where expectations are raised. You have fully formed ideas about exactly what should be there. And when you were saying earlier, we're in the land of prequels and sequels. We seem to be living through a stage of developing these universes, and that comes with great security, of course, because you think you can bank upon it from a publishing point of view or from a movie making point of view. But there are dangers as well, because Bond had established in the public consciousness as a fully formed character. So to go back to the beginning, to go to Bond Begins, to have the try and find the backstory is fraught. I thought this came out really well. I thought it was hugely enjoyable, and I think that it belongs on the shelf. I have a first edition advanced reader's copy, as yet unsigned, which I will not be giving up to the jumble sale in the local village.
I really hope it doesn't end up there. That would be an absolute tragedy. One thing that I did want us to talk about first was, I think this is a great example of a book that, even if you aren't a fan of the other Bond books, if you haven't read any other Ian Fleming, it's a great one to start with. Now, I read William Boyd's version solo. It was actually my first appearance on radio. I was actually reviewing that book, and I was at odds with everybody else in the room because I didn't really like it. I thought Bond came across as a really arrogant, horrible character. And I don't know whether it's because when he's just starting out, he's more likable because he's not as arrogant and he's got less swagger about him because that's the stage he's at as a character, or whether that is more to do with the way that it's written and the way certain authors treat him as a character.
I think this Bond is really refreshing. I couldn't agree more. I think it's a great entry point in. I think a lot of that is because Horowitz is a much more likeable fellow than Fleming. Fleming was quite nasty. His Bond, if you go through the books, is really quite nasty. And as you get later on in the Bond books, you're dealing with something that's already become a business. It's lost a lot of a charm. And when some of the other writers have tried to take it on, to try and keep that nasty streak of Bond without necessarily being Fleming, I think it can fall flat. I think some of those other reworked Bonds can be a little bit of an acquired taste. You've got to be really into the universe. Whereas here, you've got an idea of Bond already, and the period piece nature of this, I thought, worked really well, because you're there in the late 40s, early 50s, and it's setting up the historical context to it all, as well as to the character.
Mm. There's a vulnerability about Bond in this one. There's a real kind of sense that you see him when he's going to meet M for the, and he's, you know, getting his 007 status. There's a description, and there's a nervousness about him. There's a vulnerability that we're not so familiar with in recent time, because obviously we've got the movies and things like that that everyone's familiar with. And is it Daniel Craig?
Yes.
So it was really nice to see the how he started.
Well, that vulnerability that you mentioned, that's something that's very much apparent when Daniel Craig took over the role with Casino Royale, which was, you know, when he's just started out as Bond in the books as well. And that really comes across. And we actually asked the business breakfast team at ARN Dubai Eye what they thought of who the best Bond on screen was.
Hands down, best James Bond, Daniel Craig, because the man looks as though he could actually kill you.
I was one of those people that grew up with Sean Connery as James Bond, but I always thought he took it too seriously, as if he actually believed that he was James Bond. So when Roger Moore came along and gave that pomposity a much-needed deflate, I thought, brilliant, he's doing it tongue-in-cheek. So for my favourite Bond, it has to be Roger Moore.
Who's my favourite James Bond? I'm going to go with a very conventional answer and say Sean Connery. There have been fabulous Bonds. Daniel Craig is a very close second. I think he's a superb Bond, and he's from the northwest of England, and he's got blonde hair like me. But it has to be Sean Connery. The most iconic Bond portrayal has to be Goldfinger. And it's not just Sean Connery, as fabulous as he was. It's the Aston Martin DB5 that he drives in Goldfinger. The scenes at Fort Knox, that is quintessential Bond for me. Sean Connery gets it by a nose from Daniel Craig.
Some opinions there on a very controversial topic, who's been the best Bond on screen. So 4001 if you want to disagree or agree with any of those opinions. What about in the studio? How do we feel about this?
I think Daniel Craig, yes. Because what I love about Daniel Craig is that I remember when he first got the part, and I don't know if you remember, there was uproar in the news. How dare they have a blonde Bond, and he's going to be terrible, he doesn't fit the part at all. There were petitions. I remember reading things online of people kind of arguing and setting up petitions that he shouldn't be Bond. And then he did the first movie and suddenly it went quiet and everyone went, oh, okay, yeah,
he was quite good,
okay, fine.
What about you, Charlie?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because a great character like this, there's always the uproar when the baton's being passed on. I think Craig's been absolutely brilliant, and I think there's one more to come, and then apparently that will be the end of the Daniel Craig era, and there'll be a new Bond movie coming, and this book is most likely to be that new movie. So
I hope so.
Who's going to play that Bond?
Speaking of this book likely to be that new movie, it is... When you're reading it, you do see the film. It's very classic Bond. So, if you liked the older Bond films where he was always kind of palsy with the villain, and you knew that the villain knows that Bond is Bond, and that the Bond knows that the villain is the villain, but they don't have the proof yet, and they're not quite at kind of like the torture chase scene yet. And then there's also the nefarious goings on that are packaged in, like, corporations that are clearly up to no good, but Bond's trying to find out what's going on. That's classic Bond, and that's all in this book.
Yeah, it's all there. It ticks all those boxes of familiarity, and it's of course treading a very fine line there, because too much familiarity and it can seem, not, it doesn't quite approach cliche or pastiche, but it is getting a little bit close sometimes. There are great baddies, and there are great evil lairs, and there is fantastic setting on a French Riviera, but he writes it so well, and he writes it from a very filmic and TV point of view that you can rattle through it, and the descriptions really do work, both from the setting and also from the action. He's a great action writer, but I thought he wrote very well here in terms of giving us the setting, taking us to the south of France.
Yeah, he did. I've actually got an excerpt that I want to read about that as well. It's midway through the book, and it's not giving away any spoilers. It's purely just to illustrate how good Horowitz is at describing the location. The road from Menton is a gift to thrill seekers. It climbs steeply through a series of hairpin bends with dazzling views of the deep blue Mediterranean Sea before plunging into the dense forests of the Alpes Maritimes with olives, cypresses and pine trees taking over from the orange and lemon trees that have been cultivated on the slopes below. Apart from the tarmac and the occasional telegraph pole, it feels that nothing has changed here in 1,000 years. Saracen fortresses, or the remains of them, still stand guard over rocky crags, and villages cling to hilltops, with church bells sounding out from improbably large cathedrals. The houses are pink and yellow and white and green, and many of them still lack electricity. It's a world apart from the coast of the Riviera. A train line runs up to the town of Sospel, tunneling through the rocks that it was unable to bypass. but it is in a fast car with the roof down that you will fully experience the heat, the smell of herbs and wildflowers, and the sense of calm that you have momentarily broken the modern world crushing through the ancient.
Fantastic. How do you not want to spend your summer in a fast car with a top down with Horowitz's Forever and a Day in your back pocket? I mean, just come on.
I put this down and I was looking at flights.
It has that cinematic quality. You're hearing that and you almost imagine it like it's the film, and you're, the camera's panning out far and you see the car just around the edge of the coast. It really has that sense of a film about it.
And I think
Horowitz has got a great history of writing, obviously, for film and TV, and that comes across. But also, I thought that some of the best of Ian Fleming's work isn't just in creating this sort of fraught character of Bond, who is both wonderfully heroic and also reasonably questionably questionable moral standards. It's the travel writing. Fleming was a great travel writer, and this is a fantastic piece. Yeah, I am definitely in the South France. I'll see you there.
We have to go away for a couple of minutes. Before we do, we've had a text message in on favourite Bond. Someone has said Brosnan ... That's Ian.
Controversial. I don't know. I've got a soft spot for Lazenby.
I have a soft spot for Timothy Dalton, and every time I say that, everybody just groans and cringes.
The Bookshelf. What you should be reading.
If you're wondering if we're going to keep playing that throughout the show, the answer is yes, because I said so. And we are talking about Forever and a Day, which is the latest kind of installment in the Bond franchise written by Anthony Horowitz. It was published on the 31st of May. It's the prequel to Casino Royale, which was the first book by Ian Fleming, which was published in, do you remember, Charlie? Am I putting you on the spot
now? You put me on the spot there. Published in 1958.
I'm going to just pretend that you got that right because I have no way of checking right now. And it is the story of how Bond becomes 007 as we know him in the books and in the many films that we have seen. And we've been asking who you think is the best Bond on screen. It's a controversial topic. Someone, Ian has texted in saying Pierce Brosnan. There's been a lot of oohs and ahs about that in the studio.
Oh, and some counters with no, it's Timothy Dalton. Somebody in the studio is insistent upon.
Yes. Roger Moore is the best Bond, especially when he ran across the path of Crocs from Finn. He went to the same school as me in Putney. He was known as Irish. My claim to fame, Ian. Ah, okay. Hence the Brosnan thing there. Okay. No, not that you're name dropping or anything. I love it really though, Ian. So we were talking about the book and how it's very classic Bond. It's very familiar. And you were saying off air that maybe it's a little bit too familiar.
That's always going to be the danger. And when we're talking back about those classic Bonds and Roger Moore running over the Crocs, there is a question of this is a very familiar Bond. It's a very familiar setting. We're at the casino in Monte Carlo, of course, where slightly strangely this brand new secret agent, brand new 007, he has literally just been recruited. A wonderful early scene where he's nervously going for the interview, walking through the corridors of power. Well, when he arrives at the casino in Monte Carlo, he is greeted as if he is Roger Moore. The owner of the casino comes to him and thanks him for having just the previous summer rescued the casino. Very good story. Rescued the casino from being shelled by a Russian oligarch in his super yacht, which also had cannons on because we're in that post Second World War age. So there's a mix of familiarity and of course suspension of disbelief. But I thought that was great. Maybe it lacks that absolute killer running across the Croc scene, but then it does have some superb villains. We have a wonderful Corsican mob boss, and we have an American isolationist billionaire who's a bit crazy and trying to take over the world, which is obviously an entirely new concept.
And he has a mega yacht, obviously, or of course, very large boat.
Of course, yeah, and of course there has to be fast cars and mega yachts and a baddie's lair in a laboratory in a forest, which is this time peculiarly protected not just by ring fences and armed guards in uniform, but by some killer stinging nettles.
Yeah. All of this would seem silly in the hands of other writers, I think, though. But Anthony Horowitz completely manages to sell it to you so that you read the book in one sitting and you enjoy the writing as well. One attention to detail that I like, so style, he's kept... I think Ian Fleming did this as well. So he would talk about the kind of suit that Bond was wearing. And he does this with what the ladies are wearing as well. And I do like the attention to detail there. You you can absolutely picture everything that's happening. It's incredibly cinematic. One thing that I wanted us to talk about was the villains. So, and this occurred to me not just from the films but in the books. So you've got this big Corsican mob. Is he a mob boss, a gangster?
He's described as being about 500 pounds as well, isn't he? Absolutely giant man. I imagined him when I was reading it. You know the penguin character from Batman?
Very good, yes.
I really just imagined that type of round person with a long pointy nose and really, really vivid.
And he has this scar across his neck as well. And it got me thinking about all the kind of scarred and disfigured villains that we find in Bond films and Bond books. And there are quite a lot of them. And I found it hard to think of one that actually wasn't scarred and disfigured. And I just wondered what your thoughts were on that whole correlation between ugliness in person kind of signifying badness of character.
Oh, I think that's very much in Fleming. He would quite shamelessly say that about his books, wouldn't he? He referred to them as nothing but, you know, pillow fantasies, and he would insist on just rattling out 2,000 words every morning before his first cocktail, and he didn't want it to be overthought. He wanted the beautiful to win. He wanted the scarred to be the villains. I couldn't agree with you more, though, that Horowitz is handling things which could easily become cliche in others' hands, and yet he does so here, where you start to feel this absolute caricature. We're dealing with cartoon characters here, really, and yet the Corsican baddie, even the lunatic American
wolf,
there's a way of buying into them a bit, and the central female character is significantly more developed than in many of the other stories.
One thing I will say, though, is even though that whole trope of having the badly scarred villain, the ugly villain, it's still there in this book, but I think that the motives for the villains have become better with the literary adaptations, or whatever you call it when a writer takes on the mantle of some of Ian Fleming. I don't know what that would be called. Adaptation, I suppose.
Yeah.
And also with the films now. So you've got, for example, Raoul Silver in Skyfall. For most of the film, he doesn't look disfigured at all. But then towards the end of the film, you actually notice that he's got actually a mouthpiece in, and when he takes it out, his kind of face actually
sinks in.
But the motivations for his character and for his evil and for his villainy were there at the beginning of the film, and it wasn't kind of triggered in your mind when you're watching it because of the facial disfigurement.
I think sometimes creating these kind of, as you were saying, caricatures of characters, it's almost kind of a stereotype of a villain, of a goodie, of a Bond girl, I think doing that allows us this safety net and this security as a reader that, okay, I know what I'm getting. I know that that's that person and that's that, and I don't have to concentrate too much on that, and I can really actually then focus on, like you saying, the underlying, the thing that makes them bad, or the message or the plot or the story, because we're not having to delve hugely into these overcomplicated characters. Like, you feel safe in this type of book. You're in that safety net of, you know what you're getting.
Because in reality, the truth is that often the most villainous people are the ones who look the most normal and who are the most charming and who are perhaps the most like Bond rather than like the big Corsican gangster. Another thing that occurred to me was, in the books, you're actually told about James Bond having this scar down his face. And I think perhaps more interesting than the presence of disfigurement in the villains in the books and in the films is the absence of the scar on Bond in the movies.
And that scar's been there in all the Fleming books.
Yeah, it has.
And there's a recurring scene of Bond, when in absent-minded moments, picking away at the scar on his face. And in a description which is very similar to how the baddies are described, and that has completely been taken off. Which again, it brings to that fascinating thing. Of course, you know, what happens post Daniel Craig? What happens if you try and reboot it? Which way would you turn it? I like the way that Horowitz has gone back to the beginning, back to the historical setting. I think that's great. But in terms of the way the whole book is structured and the way a movie would be structured, It is lovely and familiar, and he writes very well. It is it's a read in one sitting book, unapologetically and brilliantly for that. Mm. It's absolutely great books that are designed to be read like that. But it perhaps misses a little bit of developing those deeper themes, because it's got the setting, and yet it quite studiously avoids any geopolitics, any more developed aspects of character, any slightly darker themes that could come through. I felt a little bit too deliberately avoided.
Mm. I think that's a good observation. I want to just let you know that the Business Breakfast team have answered a few questions about Bond. They've talked about who they think their favourite screen Bond is, and here they are talking about who they think is the best Bond villain.
This villain? I quite like the guy with the gold teeth.
The best villain for me was the one who was in most films, Blofeld, named after the father of the cricket commentator, Henry Blofeld. He was in From Russia with Love, Thunderball, You Only Live Twice, On Her Majesty's Secret Service, Diamonds Forever, For Your Eyes Only. And for pure staying power as a villain, Blofeld gets my vote.
Oh, the best villain is absolutely hands down the German actor Kurt Jurgens in the 1977 movie The Spy Who Loved Me. He played the shipping industrialist Karl Stromberg. Remember, he had that wonderful underwater home that came out of the sea and sunk back into the sea. He was just so nasty and mean and threatening and villainous. Some of the more contemporary Bonds have been a little bit wimpy and weedy. Jonathan Pryce, oh dearie me, he wouldn't frighten a fly. But Kurt Jurgens, my, he was scary. And as an aside, I have to say, same movie, my favourite Bond girl, Barbara Bach, as Agent Amasova in that movie, was just spectacular. But Kurt Jurgens, Karl Stromberg, hands down the best Bond villain.
That was Brandy, Malcolm and Richard from The Business Breakfast talking about who they think is the best Bond villain from the series, either book or film or both.
The Bookshelf, what you should be reading.
Charlie Scott, the books publisher from Motivate Publishing, is our guest reviewer today. You've previously been on the show talking about Casino Royale being one of your favourite books, so it's fitting that you're here talking about this one.
It's wonderful to be here, and yes, Casino Royale is one of my absolute favourite books, and had until now been the beginning of the whole Bond universe. Had been the first time we met James Bond would be had previously been on the beach in Le Touquet, and here we meet Bond the first time, because this is the Bond Begins. This is a prequel to Casino Royale. It is literally just out, in the last couple of days.
Yeah.
And it is going to be a smash hit. It's a great read. It's a classic Bond. It is a really good way to be able to get into the Bond universe without going through some of the older books, which might well feel slightly dated now, I'd think, compared to this. Whereas, reading this, you may, like Annabelle, book your flight to the south of France to spend the summer driving fast cars with a top down.
That's still a dream, not booked. Speaking of classic Bond, there are a couple of things that I wanted to talk about. So motifs that we associate with Bond all the time: Shaken Not Stirred, 007. Mm. Let's start with 007, because how does that come about?
Yeah, absolutely. There's this great part in the book, and the first to say before I read this out, M is a man. So we were talking, not Judy Dench, about it took us a long time reading this, James referring to M as yes sir, and you're thinking, don't call Judy sir, how rude. So just brace yourself for that. But this is how he gets his number. So M reached for his pipe, although he didn't light it. There is one more thing. You're going to need a number. You'll be working with 008 and 0011. I don't know why, but 009 sprung to mind. What do you think? Bond had been getting to his feet, but he sat down again. If it's all the same to you, sir, I'd like to take over the 007 designation. M raised an eyebrow. Really? Why? Well, I suppose there are two reasons. The first is that I knew Bond named the man who had died. I'd go so far as to say we were friends, and I'd like to keep his memory alive, flying the flag, so to speak. And the second? I think it sends out a message. You can take one of us down, but it changes nothing. We'll come back the same and as strong as ever. M exchanged a glance with his chief of staff, then nodded. Well, it makes no difference to me, as long as you're not superstitious. Just make sure you take care of yourself. Good luck. The following day, James Bond, 007, left for France.
I thought that was great.
That's great, isn't it? And it's wonderful. You get all these the key foundation myths, the key character traits of Bond come out in this. And again, it's important to have a suspension of disbelief, because it also becomes apparent very early on that he's going to refer to himself as Bond, James Bond, all the time, even though without needing to, you know, go through the full secret spy playbook. Presumably that's not necessarily the first point of call.
I do think it's interesting that he never just says, "Hi, my name's James."
No.
Like, who else does the surname thing?
Yeah.
No one.
The first time it appears in the book, quite early on, there is a little, "Oh, he did it!" Like the James Bond thing.
Yeah, but yeah, again, the book works really well because it plays with these things. It's and they've all got to come up. We have the baddie referring to him as Mr. Bond,
yeah.
As you know is going to happen. We get the backstory as to why he will always prefer his drink shaken, not stirred. We get the backstory to his favourite brand of cigarettes and where he gets his suits tailored, and his preferred brand of cigarettes comes up when he is told off for his previous brand being a little too girly, I think he's accused of.
Yeah, and also I think the original material by Ian Fleming is used quite well in this, although there's some differences of opinion there.
I think it's the original material by Ian Fleming is a beautifully crafted sort of Ian Fleming short story. It reads really well, like one of those great 1960s short stories. It's a fantastic construct, and it's a really great story. It just seems slightly surprising the way it's constructed. So we've got this new secret agent who arrives in Monte Carlo for the first time, and as he walks into the casino, he's greeted like a returning hero because he'd had this great moment a year before where he'd saved the world,
yeah.
whilst doing his previous job, which seemed a little bit at odds with this fact that he was the newbie.
And it is just thrown in literally like an anecdote, which is the funniest thing, because when the waiter comes over or the manager and is like, "Welcome back, blah blah blah," you think, oh, maybe there was a fire or something a bit more realistic, like perhaps he helped with some sort of but
well,
it's
he saved someone's
a yacht
cat.
Was training its missiles on the hotel and Bond happened to be there. It's just I totally get where you're coming from. That I kind of skim read it and thought, oh, okay.
But that's kind of the point of all of it though, isn't it? I mean, we'll talk about this more, but yes, James Bond novels are spy novels, but they are escapism. I mean, if you're looking at George Smiley, that's a different kind of spy literature. That's kind of hyper-realistic. And this is meant to be escapism. Like you say, you've got caricatures and you've got these tropes, these motifs that we know and love. And part of the joy of that is the familiarity of it.
It's all about familiarity. It's more caper than dark thriller. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm sure all of us read this in a single setting with a smile on your face. You enjoyed it. There's nothing to apologise. A book that you can sit and read with a smile on your face, single setting, and then enjoy the stories about driving fast around south of France.
We've got a couple of minutes left to talk about another important Bond motif, and that's the Bond girl, who in this case is actually more of a Bond woman. And I think that she's described and treated particularly well in Horowitz's telling here.
Yeah, I this was probably the bit I enjoyed most about the book, because it gave it a bit of historical context. It also just felt a little bit fresher than the way it Bond girls in the past, even though that term is pastiche and it is awkward, and this doesn't address that completely, but it's just a fresh take. And yes, we're dealing with a Bond woman who has been a special operations executive during the war, and there is a question hanging over the which side she is on and who, whether she should be trusted or not, that runs all the way through it. And that's great. That was really enjoyable.
Yeah, and in many ways she has more experience as an agent than he does. Mm-hmm. I mean, her background is Bletchley Park, yeah. and
she's significantly better at it than him. I mean, you
yes.
know, he's as inept in this as he is in many of the movies, getting himself, you know, knocked out and a gun pulled on him within the first 10 pages, getting
runs out of bullets,
runs out of bullets,
and
gets caught and tied
him.
Up, and she keeps saving him, and she has her own spy ring which she seems to be running, but he doesn't clock onto.
Oh, when
know.
They're in the in the stinging nettles, and it's all about to go wrong, and then, oh no, I've just brought my team of spies with me. She's prepared.
We've got a few more thoughts left on Bond, so stay tuned. 4001 if you want to get involved in the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. We'll be right back.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
We are talking about James Bond. We're looking at Forever and a Day by Anthony Horowitz, the latest in the Bond series. It's just been released on the 31st of May, and we're kind of finishing up the conversation about it at the moment. There's one thing that I thought that we could do, and you mentioned this to me. I didn't know this was a thing. So by reading the first page and kind of the last page, what's that?
There's the idea with books like this. The first page and the last line will give you the a snapshot of the book. So can you go through, can you read the first page and the last line and frankly not want to pick it up and make it part of your summer reading list?
Oh, basic. Okay, go for it.
You want? Let's go.
Yes.
So, Forever and a Day begins. So, 007 is dead. Yes, sir, I'm afraid so. M took a last fleeting look at the photographs that lay scattered across his desk that had been sent to him. They'd been taken from different angles, but show the same bleak image. A dead man, lying face down in dark, glistening water, his hand stretched out limply above his head, as if in one last futile attempt at surrender. Eventually, the police had pulled him out and laid him on the quayside so that closer pictures could be taken of his face, his hands, the three holes in the breast of his jacket where the bullets had penetrated. He had dressed expensively. M remembered him sitting in this very office only a month ago, wearing a suit that had just been made for him by the tailor he liked to visit just off Savile Row. The suit had kept its shape, M reflected. It was a man who was lying there, dripping wet and lifeless, who had lost his. That's the first page. And the last line? Bond drove out, leaving behind him the memory of what he had just done. He felt nothing.
Ooh, dead. Yes.
I love that you managed to, you started to sing it.
I didn't know it was coming in. I thought, I'll just give it to you guys. I'm feeling the moment.
Yeah, how good is that?
Well done. So we've talked about Bond motifs. We've talked about how readable this is. It really is a wonderfully paced book. I mean, you've got moments of quiet intrigue throughout, and then it kind of picks up, and the action sequences are wonderful. One thing that Horowitz is very good at is he's great at action sequences, and he's also good at those quieter moments as well. And I think his range as a writer comes across in this really well.
Yeah, I think this really does belong on the shelf. I want this on the shelf alongside the full collection. I think it's pretty much a must read, and it'll be done in one sitting.
Going beyond Bond just now, we're talking about spies in literature, and I was just wondering who the best spy in literature would be if you kind of had to decide that. So have a think about that. We asked the Dubai Eye team about this on the Business Breakfast team, and this is what they had to say.
James Bond is not the best spy in literature. The books are okay, but I have to say, for my money, I would read a Jean Le Carré novel any day. William Boyd's female spy novel Restless is also absolutely brilliant, one of my favourite books.
In terms of whether James Bond is my favourite spy, I think the answer's no. I wouldn't trust him. He had so many indiscreet liaisons, shall we put it that way, that one of those indiscreet liaisons must have blabbed to somebody. I wouldn't trust him an inch. In terms of favourite secret agents, of course it would have to be Maxwell Smart from the series Get Smart, possibly even Simon Templar from the Saint series by Leslie Charteris. Certainly not James Bond.
Is James Bond the best spy character in literature? I'd have to say yes. And the reason I say that is partly I don't read an awful lot of literature. And when I do read spy novels, they tend to be James Bond ones. Even the contemporary ones, such as the one by Jeffrey Deaver that was set here in Dubai. If I'm buying a trashy novel to take on vacation to read on the beach, I will buy the latest James Bond novel. So for me, yes, James Bond, even if it's not in the movies, even if it's a paperback on a beach in Spain, is the best spy in literature.
Bless your honesty, Richard. That was the Business Breakfast team on who they think is the best spy in literature. Have you had a think about this now? Do you think James Bond is, or?
I mean, I think William Boyd's Restless is an absolutely brilliant book, and I'm sure everyone will enjoy it. But of course Bond is the best spy. No character endures like Bond does. No character has been through so many iterations. No character can generate so much debate and intrigue. Is it the highest work of literature? Perhaps not. But I do think as a character that can endure like that is everything.
Well, I think, yes, probably it is James Bond. I think going back, though, one of my favourite villainous spy characters who kind of looks in on everyone and then feeds back is Iago in Othello.
Oh, yeah, you're right. He is a spy.
Yeah, a huge spy. The first spy, maybe. So, yeah, possibly Iago for me. But you know, Bond is brilliant. And Bond, particularly in this book, is fantastic. It's really great to understand Bond in a bit more detail. Annabelle?
We actually had a comment on Dubai Eye's Instagram feed that I wanted to mention. So Anamika Chatterjee, we asked, you know, who do you think is the best spy in literature? Do you think it's Bond? And she said no. And she said, I wouldn't say that someone is necessarily better than him, but the films, especially the recent ones, have led to a Bond fatigue, in her opinion. I'd love to have more spies modelled on Le Carré's Harry Pendle. And don't know about that. The thing is, I'm kind of with Richard Dean on this, because my familiarity with spies in literature, Bond is the one that comes to mind most frequently, and I think part of that is the cartoonish villains. It is the caricatures, in the same way that you think of comic book characters, they come to mind very easily. I do want to take you up on that recommendation of reading William Boyd's Restless. Another book I've read was Ian McEwan's Sweet Tooth, which does have kind of some spy themes through it, but it's a standalone book. And
also in this book, 16, she's a spy or an ex-spy. She's brilliant.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, yeah. Like a spin-off series of her.
That's
yeah.
exactly what I was thinking. Yeah. She's great.
And actually, interestingly, in the acknowledgments, the name for her. So can I talk about this a little bit?
Yeah,
Horowitz talks about how he offered the opportunity to appear as a character in the book as an auction to raise money for the Old Vic. Oh. And so two people bid for this to have their name in the book. And so Reed Griffith, who is the... Is he the CIA?
He's a CIA.
Yeah, CIA agent in the book. So he won one of the bids, and so he appears in his own name from chapter 5 onwards. And then a lady called Joanne McPike also made a substantial donation, and so the character of Joanne Brochet, who is Madame 16, is inspired by her because Brochet is the French word for pike. So what an amazing opportunity.
I did read that, and I wondered whether she was actually really miffed when she read it.
Because it's not her name.
It's like, it's obviously not my name. Yeah. She's just made it French.
That's true, actually.
I don't know how she feels about that. We might have to get in touch with this lady, Mrs. Pike. One other thing that I want to share with you. So we asked more of these Bond questions to the rest of the Dubai Eye team. Here's what they had to say.
I'm a big Piers Brosnan fan, purely because I think he was the one that started to play Bond the way Ian Fleming wrote the character a little bit more. He's a little bit more dirty, a little bit more nasty. Plus, you know, just got a thing for Piers Brosnan, basically. He's awesome. Favourite villain? Always had a penchant for Jaws. I thought he was fantastic because he was kind of the villain, and then you kind of went down the emotional lines and got emotionally involved with him and his girlfriend, and they kind of all became friends in the end, which was nice.
And do you think James Bond is probably the best spy ever in literature?
I would have, probably, yes. It's definitely the longest running, and it just keeps on going, and there's no end in sight for the franchise, but that's for sure.
Got a lot of time for Daniel Craig. I think Casino Royale is probably my favourite James Bond film. I got to say, though, the opening scene of the first ever James Bond, Sean Connery playing Baccarat, I think it was, that is the very essence of who James Bond was supposed to be. If you haven't seen that scene, it is on YouTube. Go and find it. That sums up James Bond. And for me, Sean Connery, he just had the charm, he had the class, he had the sophistication. He was the very essence of James Bond.
What about a villain, the scariest or that your favourite villain?
You know what? I love Goldfinger, mainly because I love golf, and they have a very memorable game of golf, do James Bond and Goldfinger in that film. Also, he's one of the most cheerful villains in the entire series. There's a side to him that isn't perhaps all... he seems to enjoy inflicting pain on his enemies, and that was probably one of the best James Bond films that I've ever seen.
And do you think James Bond the best spy ever in literature?
I'm not sure about the best, definitely the best known, Mark.
Well, when you're talking James Bond, definitely for me, my favourite was Roger Moore. I thought he had the panache, the style, he looked the best ever in a tuxedo, and he was just the coolest guy. And his favourite movie, or my favourite movie from Roger Moore, was Live and Let Die. I think it's got the best theme song ever from a James Bond film, and it was an absolute knockout. So I'm going to go with Roger Moore. As for villain, it's got to be Jaws. For me, he was, of course, played by Richard Kiel in The Spy Who Loved Me and also in Moonraker. And I think he was just scary from head to foot. And those teeth, I wouldn't fancy those coming down on my neck, I can tell you. So, yeah, my favourite villain, definitely Jaws. And, yeah, is James Bond the most famous spy in literature? Without a doubt.
It's got to be Sean Connery, right? He hails from my neck of the woods over in Scotland. He had everything. He had everything you associate with James Bond. He was suave, he was sophisticated, and he was handsome, a bit like myself as well, Mark. So Sean Connery would be my best James Bond. As for a villain, I think you can't really look past Nic Nac from The Man with the Golden Gun. He was Scaramanga's little henchman, and he always stood out in my mind as a young boy.
Lots of opinions there on who the best Bond is, best villain and best spy in literature. And thanks to the Dubai Eye team for all your thoughts on that. It was great to hear. And also for everybody who's texted in to say who they think their favourite Bond is. See, Ian, you do have a fellow Pierce Brosnan fan there. I think that was Emma Brain. And that concludes our Bond chat today. Thank you, Charlie, for coming in
to
review.
Thank you so much.
Forever and a Day. It's just been published. I don't think it's available here yet, but do keep an eye out for it because it is brilliant. You'll read it in one sitting, and it's a great book for if you're a fan of the Bond novels, the Bond films already, or if you haven't read a Bond book yet. This is a great one to start with. It's by Anthony Horowitz.